of the February sitting, 99-3271 CR State versus Deborah Noble. Ms. Moeller, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court. I represent the petitioner, the state of Wisconsin. This matter is here on the state's petition for a review of a decision of the Court of Appeals for District 4, which reversed Deborah Noble's perjury conviction. Noble's conviction was based on false testimony she gave before a John Doe hearing in front of Crawford County Judge Michael Kirchman on April 23, 1999. The Court of Appeals found that there was sufficient evidence to sustain Noble's conviction, but it nevertheless reversed that conviction because two members of the court found that her John Doe testimony was improperly admitted since it was given in response to questioning conducted by a non-lawyer, Special Agent David Matthews of the Wisconsin Department of Justice. While the majority of the Court of Appeals believed that ordering the exclusion of the John Doe transcript was a less drastic sanction than outright dismissal of the criminal complaint, in this case, that is a distinction without a difference, because the perjury charge was based solely on the testimony that Noble gave at the John Doe. Therefore, if the transcript of her testimony is excluded, the state cannot possibly retry her for perjury. The question before this court, then, is whether Noble should be immune from a perjury prosecution just because the questions she answered under oath and answered falsely were asked by a non-lawyer who had the permission of the John Doe judge to engage in this questioning. For a number of reasons, the state submits that this court should answer that question with a resounding no. The state has argued in both of its briefs before this court why the Court of Appeals erred in finding that Special Agent Matthews was violating the statute which prohibits the unauthorized practice of law. And the state adheres to that position today. But even if this court were to disagree, it should reject Noble's argument and the Court of Appeals' conclusion that suppression of her testimony is either an appropriate or a necessary sanction. The general rule, which this court most recently cited in its decision in State versus Raflick 2 months ago, is that suppression is appropriate only when there has been a constitutional violation or when a statute specifically provides for suppression as a remedy for its violation.
Counsel, it's my understanding that your opposing counsel has drawn a distinction, as I believe the Court of Appeals did, between suppression and exclusion. Do you see any real difference between those two? And if so, what difference do you see?
The terminology generally differs in the sense that suppression is viewed as a remedy for wrongdoing or constitutional violation, whereas exclusion can be applied for a violation of an evidentiary rule. In this case, however, I don't think there is a distinction because there's never been a claim of any kind of an evidentiary violation. And what Noble is arguing before this court is that she had some sort of a due process right, a constitutional right, to be questioned by a person who had a law license. The Court of Appeals did not find a constitutional violation. The Court of Appeals specifically found it had to find an exception to the general rule that you don't use suppression where there's not a constitutional violation or a statute that provides suppression by saying that, well, we're not really suppressing her here, we're simply excluding it. But as a practical matter, this has no difference. This does not make a difference in this case. And my opponent is arguing that there was a constitutional violation, but he has cited absolutely no authority for the view that a witness, whether that witness is a John Doe witness or a witness in a criminal case, has some sort of a due process right to be questioned by a lawyer. And I think it's apparent that if you've got a pro se criminal defendant who is exercising his or her right to self-representation under the Constitution, that if a witness is questioned by such a person, the witness doesn't have the right to perjure himself or herself just because a lawyer is not asking the questions.
No, but
well, let's assume for a minute that this is the unauthorized practice of law. Do you think that that's a procedural due process violation, then, to have a person, not a lawyer, questioning the witness, the John Doe?
No, I don't think that it's a procedural due process violation because I don't think that there is any such right that a person possesses to be questioned specifically by someone who has a law license. I mean, if you look at this court's decision in Pamanette versus State, there you had somebody who was being prosecuted by a district attorney where the defendant, after he was convicted of a felony, said, well, this district attorney did not have the right to prosecute me. And although this court eventually rejected that argument on the merits, the court said it wouldn't make any difference. Even if the district attorney's acts were illegal, they were not void. And the same is true of other cases involving the unauthorized practice of law that the state has cited in its brief, both Drugsvold versus Small Claims Court and Littleton versus Langlois. This court's made clear that the acts are not void. And I think the same is true here. There is no authority for the view that you have any kind of a constitutional right, due process or otherwise, to only have a lawyer question you.
Counsel.
Justice Babbage.
I want you to see if a thought that I have can be developed a little bit, because this is not felt right to me, the suppression. And as I think about the normal suppression case, it's an officer of the state seizing evidence unlawfully. And if it's Officer A, but if Officer B does it, it's okay. In other words, there's nobody. No officer of the state can take this evidence, and so we throw it out. Now here, we've got an unauthorized practice of law, but there's nothing inherently wrong with the questioning because it could have been done lawfully by a special prosecutor, another lawyer, the judge himself could have done it. And I'm wondering if that's a distinction that's worth developing at all.
I think it definitely is, because Judge Vandehey, who was the trial judge at the perjury trial, specifically said he couldn't see why it made any difference who was asking the questions. The fact is that Ms. Noble was sworn to tell the truth, and before she ever was asked one question, Judge Kirchman advised her that she could be charged with perjury or false swearing if she were to give any false testimony under oath. Judge Kirchman advised her that she had the right to refuse to answer questions based on her right against self-incrimination. And she, in fact, had a lawyer who was there with her at the John Doe, whom she was free to consult. And the fact that a non-lawyer, here Agent Matthews, asked the questions isn't the reason why she lied. And, in fact, if you look at the Court of Appeals brief filed by Noble, I think it was on page 37, she conceded that a person who had a law license could have asked the same inelegant kind of questions that Agent Matthews did, and the answers might very well have been the same. So there's really not even a nexus between the violation here, assuming that this court finds a violation, and her conscious decision to lie under oath. At the time she lied, if we are to believe what her former attorney said, neither she nor Mr. Brinkman even knew that Special Agent Matthews wasn't a lawyer.
And what's the nexus that is present in the normal suppression case with the police?
I think normally it's sort of a but-for connection, that but for the police violating your Fourth Amendment rights and taking evidence they didn't have the right to, you wouldn't be convicted. And, I mean, even in the Fourth Amendment context, you have situations where there has been a Fourth Amendment violation, and perhaps the trial judge erroneously decides that the search or the seizure was okay, and then on appeal, the Court of Appeals or this court disagrees, you don't automatically get a reversal of your conviction. If the court can find that the admission of this erroneously seized evidence was harmless, the conviction stands. So even in the area of a constitutional violation of a defendant's rights, every time there's a violation, there isn't necessarily a concomitant remedy. And I think it goes without saying that here where at most, if this court buys my opponent's argument, at most you've got a statutory violation, and I think it's a pretty technical one, to say the least, there's no reason why Ms. Noble should be able to have some remedy for the fact that she was not even wronged by this.
Do you have a question?
I
find these arguments persuasive, but what they don't consider is how serious it is, maybe it's not, to have a non-lawyer doing lawyer work. I mean, the theory is that the court loses, as well as a client, right, for unauthorized practice of law. Now, what is unauthorized practice of law? Do we have to decide that here? It's hard when you have a transaction in a law office which doesn't use a court room. You make a will, anybody can make a will, or a financial transaction and get advice. It could be your lawyer, it needn't be a lawyer, you got a tough problem. Here, you are in a tribunal. Now, it's a peculiar tribunal, but there's a judge sitting there, there are rules of evidence or not, as the case may be. You got a tribunal and you got somebody appearing who is not a lawyer doing that, which a lawyer generally does in a tribunal, cross-examine, right?
Well, I think in this case, the state's argument is that this was not a judicial tribunal.
I know that.
Even if you assume that here there was a judicial tribunal, you still should not be suppressing.
Okay, but let's just talk about, and I think that's a very persuasive argument. But let's talk about what should the court do about unauthorized practice of law, assuming this is a tribunal, and assuming that you've got a lawyer who has now delegated to a non-lawyer appearance in court. Now, there's paralegals, and they do a lot of work outside of court, but here you really have a paralegal working in the courtroom, if we accept it as a tribunal. Suppression is used as one element, is a deterrent, right? To stop.
It's used as one what?
Deterrent.
Correct.
So how do we deter lawyers from delegating to non-lawyers what is generally considered practice of law, namely cross-examining a witness? How do we do that? Is there some charge that could be made against the detective? I suppose the DA could bring unauthorized practice of law, but that's not likely because it was the DA himself or herself that did this. Is the court obliged to file a complaint against the lawyer or have a complaint examined to see if the lawyer violated a code? I didn't look this up. There is such a code about delegating to a non-lawyer. I mean, what do you do to take care of a legal problem, a judicial problem?
Well, I think if you're talking about the narrow circumstances here, having a non-lawyer question a John Doe witness, and if you conclude this is the unauthorized practice of law, quite frankly, I believe that simple declaration is all that is needed, because I don't share the skepticism that my opponent does that if this court made that decision, that somehow judges like Judge Kirchman or other John Doe judges would simply thumb their noses at that decision. I also don't think that the prosecutors of this state would say, well, because we're not going to have this testimony suppressed, I'm going to go right ahead and I'm going to have my sheriff's deputy or my police lieutenant or my DOJ investigator, I'm going to have that person answer questions, ask questions.
Is there a violation of the attorney's code of professional conduct that can be used as a deterrent?
I believe that there is a provision. I don't have the exact site of the code with me, but I believe there is a provision that you can't allow violations of the law, knowing violations. Or I'm not sure of the exact language. And certainly, if this court were to conclude that there was a violation here, it could ask the Office of Lawyer Regulation to look into it. But even if it did, quite honestly, I think this was a fairly technical violation in the sense that it's arguable as to whether or not this was the unauthorized practice. I don't think that Judge Kirchman would have thought that this was a violation. Otherwise, he never would have gone along with the district attorney's request that Agent Matthews be allowed to do some of the questioning. I mean, this wasn't a case where you had some renegade agent come in and pretend to be a lawyer. You had the district attorney convening the John Doe, and he in fact did some of the questioning of Deborah Noble, but he turned it over to Agent Matthews because Matthews had been the one responsible for investigating the case, and Matthews had been the one who questioned Deborah Noble on April 9th. Yeah. So it was more efficient.
Linda, you just follow up. Your opposing counsel indicates that in your brief you can't identify any statutory exception or really a policy justification, but you do go on in your brief and you talk about the unauthorized practice of law and sort of indicate that, well, here it was under the supervision of the judge, it was with and at the request of the district attorney. But it's just difficult for me to understand. Obviously, this is something that rarely happens. We don't know. Are there any, you found no case on this particular situation, isn't that correct?
That's correct. I have never personally been involved in a John Doe. I've talked to a lot of attorneys in our office who have. Nobody has ever heard of the district attorney having an investigator do the questioning, which leads me to believe that this is an isolated...
But we don't know. I mean, really, so I think the court, regardless of how we come down, has to say something. It would seem to me that this is a practice that shouldn't be happening. In other words, where the special investigator, special agent would be asking questions. It's just what we don't know. So that we're in the dilemma of either we find there was unauthorized practice of law and do nothing. Do we have to, if we find that, do we have to do something? Do we have to do something?
Well, I think that if you first of all reach the issue, which I think, you know, if you wanted to, it would not even be necessary to reach the issue because you could simply find that suppression would not be appropriate even if there were a violation. But if you decide to address it and you disagree with the state's arguments and find that there was the unauthorized practice of law, I think you can certainly refer the matter to the law, Office of Lawyer Regulation with respect to the district attorney's conduct and to the Judicial Commission with respect to Judge Kirchman's conduct, because both of them were involved in the decision which led to Agent Matthews asking these questions.
And I speak for myself, as indicated, there may be some reluctance to do that, but that's what you're saying that the court could do and may, if we would go in that, you know, touch on that area.
This court could do that, and I think that, for example, for the Office of Lawyer Regulation, quite often very technical violations are dealt with by private reprimands or dismissals with caution, and maybe that's the kind of sanction that would be appropriate here. I don't think that it's really legitimate to accuse Judge Kirchman and the prosecutor of conspiring to violate the law, which Ms. Noble has done in her brief. I don't think that's what happened here. Because the John Doe is relatively informal, there are no rules of evidence. The witness can have an attorney, but the attorney cannot really object or make argument. I don't think it ever dawned on either one of them that this might be a violation of the unauthorized practice of law statute, because it wasn't as if they were trying to hide the fact that Special Agent Matthews was a non-lawyer. He was always introduced as a special agent, and the prosecutor specifically asked for and obtained Judge Kirchman's permission before he went ahead and allowed Matthews to ask any questions. And as Justice Wilcox points out, the John Doe judge has control of the proceedings. The John Doe judge is the one who is supposed to protect the rights of witnesses. And there is no right of a witness to be asked questions only by a lawyer. For example, here you could have had Mr. Baxter up there asking the questions, and after each question, Agent Matthews could have been whispering in his ear, "Ask this now." Or Agent Matthews could have scripted the questions for the prosecutor to ask. And I don't think this court would find that to be a violation. So any violation that this court might find, I think, is a fairly technical one, and one which the parties involved really did not foresee. So by no stretch of the imagination is suppression necessary to serve as a deterrent from this, you know, happening again. I just don't think it will.
Who does the unauthorized practice of law statute protect?
I think it's designed to protect generally the public who might be harmed by inadequate or unethical representation. I think this court has said that in several cases, including, I believe, the Haber decision. And here, there really wasn't anything unethical about what Agent Matthews was doing. Judge Kirchman was the one who advised Ms. Noble that she didn't have to answer questions to which the response might be privileged. She didn't have to answer if it would incriminate her. So there was somebody watching over her rights. Agent Matthews didn't do anything that was impermissible. And in terms of being inadequate, he wasn't representing her. If she thought a question was unclear and she wasn't sure how to answer it without lying, her attorney was there. She could have asked for time to confer with Mr. Brinkman. She didn't do so. Instead, she purposely lied under oath. And in fact, I think at page 41 of the partial John Doe transcript, Agent Matthews paused and basically asked her, "Do you realize the seriousness of lying in a proceeding like this?" And she said, "Yes."
Let me talk to you about a matter that's pending before the court. You would have no way of knowing about it because, and it, we've had oral argument on it, because it's a civil case, so I'm just assuming you haven't kept up with it. Statutes require that lawyers sign pleadings. And this was signed by a lawyer licensed in, and I'm sorry, I've forgotten, I think it was Minnesota, but it's irrelevant, and signed it for a lawyer who was a Minnesota lawyer but also licensed to practice in Wisconsin. And the court said, no, not good enough. So they tried to make repairs. Didn't make it very well, which I think everybody conceded it could have been made better. But then you have a pro hoc vici lawyer from Minnesota now citing some of the stuff, but not all of it, which is why it wasn't done well enough. Yes, it's a pending case.
Yes.
And the issue in the case.
Can I just ask you a question?
Okay. This is a pending case, and the issue is, do we throw the pleadings out as a matter of the law?
And you want my response as to whether you should?
Well, no, I don't want your response as to should. What I'm trying to say is there you've got a non-lawyer, not licensed in Wisconsin, and there are significant sanctions that the client is going to be penalized with, maybe, maybe not. Maybe the court will say otherwise. So what I'm trying to say is that the issue of unauthorized practice of law is bigger and different than just the particular people involved. and that there are significant sanctions. And the sanction that's asked for here is very deleterious to the state and to the people of the state, because it's a perjury charge that might get thrown out. So how can we reconcile various cases that get very technical on what lawyers can and can't do? And this one, which is, well, arguably, not is quite clear, arguably, that a non-lawyer is doing that which a lawyer does. And the sections we're talking about is 20:5.3 and 20:5.5 in the SCR. So how do you reconcile all these cases?
Well, I think in the example that you're giving, you're talking about something that would be harmful to the clients involved. Here, there is no harm that really accrued as a result of a non-lawyer asking questions. In the example of the, I think it's pronounced Jader, a Jader case, there you had somebody who was a non-lawyer, I think it was an officer of a corporation, signing a notice of appeal. And this court found that that actually deprived the appellate court of jurisdiction to consider the appeal. And so in that kind of situation, where it's a very drastic sanction in terms of what happens to the client as a result, because his or her appellate rights are extinguished, I think then you have to look at a more serious sanction in terms of the conduct of the person involved for practicing law without a license. Here you've got somebody who I'm sure Agent Matthews had no, shall we say, predisposition to practice law without a license. He was more or less entrapped into doing so because the judge and the prosecutor didn't think that the statute applied to him. So I'm not answering your question as well as you wanted, I'm sure, but I think it's such a complicated area that one size doesn't fit all, really, and I think in this particular case, because you only have this factual situation before the court, you should limit your decision to these facts. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Boyd.
Good afternoon. I'm Tom Boyd. I've been appointed to represent Deborah Noble in this matter. We're asking the court to affirm the Court of Appeals' decision to suppress the evidence of her testimony that was obtained at the John Doe hearing. The testimony in question was unlawfully obtained by the special agent, first of all, because it violated the Wisconsin laws prohibiting the unauthorized practice of law, and secondly, because it was a violation of the strict limitations and procedures required for the conduct of a John Doe hearing under the laws and the case law of this state. The evidence should be suppressed because it was obtained in violation of her rights, both as a witness and as a potential target of that John Doe investigation. And under these circumstances, suppression is the only practical and meaningful way to address what we believe is a very serious violation of the law. Wisconsin places important and strict limitations on the manner in which these hearings are to be conducted. The John Doe hearings are part of the prosecutorial process. They result in the adjudication of probable cause and the issuance of criminal complaints and arrest warrants. Accordingly, John Doe hearings require safeguards to ensure the protections of the private citizens who appear in those proceedings, both the witnesses and the targets of the investigation. The applicable statutes require that these proceedings be conducted by the district attorney. They do not provide for other attorneys to participate in the examination of witnesses. These proceedings may be and are conducted in secret. The presence and involvement of parties other than the judge and the district attorney are strictly circumscribed by statute and case law. As counsel mentioned, attorneys for witnesses may be present but cannot participate, cannot examine, cannot make argument during the course of these proceedings. Under these and this court has also held that non-parties to the proceedings may not have free access to John Doe hearings. This court has held that only under very limited circumstances, for example, can a police officer have access to the hearing. And then only in those rare circumstances where the law enforcement agent's presence is necessary to assist the district attorney, not to take the district attorney's place, but to assist. Under those circumstances, it's unthinkable that the district attorney could be permitted to turn over his or her responsibility for the examination of witnesses to anyone, much less someone who is a material prosecution witness who is not licensed to practice law.
Counsel, there's a popular saying, no harm, no foul. So, did he ask any questions that a lawyer couldn't have asked?
I've looked at the record, and I've also familiarized myself with the briefs that counsel has referenced, and I can't identify questions that other licensed attorneys may or may not have asked. And I picked up on the question that was asked earlier in terms of suppression and whether it's the actor versus the act that leads to the suppression. In this case, it's the act that I'm focusing on. It's the act that's clearly set out in the statute, that it's the district attorney who will conduct the examination, and it's licensed attorneys who are permitted to practice law. So in this case, regardless of what activity was ongoing, it's the actors that is key here. And I'd like,
So your position is that this is a violation of a statute?
It's a violation of multiple statutes, which we believe impugn the integrity of the proceeding itself. And in that regard, I'd like to pick up on the case that the state has cited recently, the State versus Ratling case, which I think was provided to the court about a week ago, dealing with the law of suppression. And in that case, both the majority opinion and the dissent focused on the neutrality, the impartiality, and the integrity of the judicial process and the judicial officer. In fact, those words, neutrality, judicial neutrality, integrity, unbiased, proceedings, detached role, those appeared 13 times in that opinion. That is the concern that I think is raised in this case. When you have a situation where an unlicensed investigator is asked by the district attorney whose responsibility it is to conduct the examination to take his place, and that activity is condoned by the district judge, you have a series of laws that are violated, which cannot help but reflect negatively and lead to a negative conclusion regarding the integrity and the impartiality of that proceeding. In this case, the unauthorized...
I was just going to ask about bias, but you're getting to it. Go ahead. I want to know how your client is biased.
But first of all, in terms of how the process reflects the bias, there's a violation of the statute prohibiting the unauthorized practice of law. There's a violation of the statute requiring the district attorney conduct the proceeding. And we also believe there's a violation of the case law indicating that non-parties, people other than the district attorney who shouldn't even be present, are permitted to participate in the process. We believe that in and of itself reflects bias on the part of the judge and the district attorney. In terms of perhaps that response to the court's question.
Counsel, the suppression is a very harsh remedy. And I make a list of the kinds of things that we are seeking to that the courts seek to accomplish with suppression. While some of the things I've got on the list is compare the normal case with the case that we've got here. Normal being, the police have unlawfully seized evidence. In that instance, the violation is constitutional. Here it's statutory. The seriousness of the offense by the police is very serious because it's a violation of the Constitution. And here, I can't get all that excited. Maybe somebody else can. The likelihood of repeating the conduct, if there is no suppression, is, I think, very high for the police. Very low here. I don't see much danger for repetition. The reward for violating the law, it's very high for police because they get the evidence in. Here, I fail to see where the reward is. We've referred to the often competitive enterprise of ferreting out crime. It's certainly present in the normal case, but here, I don't see that present. The thing that I brought up with the Attorney General, the nexus, can others do it legally with the normal case? No. And here, yes. Violation of defendant's rights. Yeah, in the normal case, it is a violation of the defendant's rights. Here, there's no violation of the defendant's rights. And then the last question I ask myself is suppression commensurate with the seriousness of the violation? And it certainly seems to be in most cases, regular cases, but here it seems to be out of whack somehow. Any comment on all the points?
I'll try to comment on at least those that I can.
A few of those.
But to respond to the first factor, what's the purpose? And again, referring to the Radlich case that counsel has cited the court to, and the court's, of course, aware of, the court describes suppression as a judge-made rule used to deter misconduct by law enforcement officials. Clearly, the violation of law, whether it's this court's decisions or the legislature's enactments, is misconduct. It's by definition misconduct, and we can have a discussion about whether it was intentional or not, but the investigator, the DA, and the court, the trial court, all have to be presumed to know that that's the law.
But there's levels of misconduct, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, some are 1s and some are 10s.
That's correct, Your Honor. We believe this is higher on the scale, given the combination of what's gone on here. And again,
The likelihood of repeating?
I think it's very likely.
We're going to have all kinds of non-lawyers asking questions if we don't suppress. Is that running out of the woodwork?
In responding, perhaps I could ask a rhetorical question. Why wouldn't they? There's no reason, there's no downside, so to speak, to follow up on the phrase, no harm, no foul. They're able to get away with this.
There's an economic response. Lawyers don't want somebody horning in on their practice.
That's true, although I don't know if the DA is concerned about that. At least with regard to this situation, and leaving aside other instances of unlawful practice, wherever they may be, whether it's in the courtroom or outside of the law office, focusing on this proceeding, if suppression is not the remedy, there's no downside, there's no reason why the judge and the prosecutor would not do this in the future. And in all due respect, I understand counsel's argument is, well, if this court states it's wrong, they'll adhere to that. But honestly, the legislature has said that this is inappropriate. They've prohibited this type of behavior, both with regard to the unauthorized practice of law and also the manner in which the John Doe proceedings are to be conducted.
What about my concern that in the normal police search, unlawful search, nobody could do it. No officer of the state could perform it. Whereas here, an awful lot of people could have done this legally.
My response would be it's the manner in which, in the normal situation, it's the manner in which the evidence is obtained. It's not that the evidence could never be admissible under any circumstances. It's whether or not the law enforcement officials went through the proper procedures to obtain that evidence. It's not so much this officer is bad, this one is not. It's how is it done? And in this case, the statute says it shall be done through the district attorney and it shall be done through licensed attorneys. So it's the method. And in this case, the person and the method come together. But I don't think that that's a sufficient reason to say suppression doesn't fit. And again, I would come back to the argument. We believe that clearly her constitutional rights as a John Doe witness and a prospective, if not the target, of this investigation have been violated. But even leaving that aside, there is no other meaningful remedy to address this type of police misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct, and judicial misconduct, except for suppression.
Counsel, to follow up Justice Babbage's questions, as I see the analysis citing the Raflick, you have suppression, the general rules of suppression is appropriate if there's a constitutional violation or if there's a statute that specifically allows for that as a remedy. The third way you can get suppression is there's some policy, and I'm looking at something like policy set forth in the Hoffman case where there was John Doe was really used in an abusive way. Is there any, so we have the general rule reiterated in Raflick, constitutional violation or statutory statement that specifically allows it, or policy considerations. Is there any, what policy consideration are you advancing here that would allow for suppression?
Several, but I'd like to pick up on the one you've mentioned, which is abuse of the John Doe process. That's what we believe has occurred here. Again, focusing at least in part on the many statutes that were violated, but also the manner in which they were violated. It wasn't just the agent coming in and deciding he would take his turn to examine witnesses. It was something that the district attorney engaged the agent to do and then got the blessing of the judge. And again, following up on the Radling case, and I know that may not have been what the court had in mind, but the court stated on repeated occasions in that decision the importance of having a judicial process and a judicial officer that maintains the integrity, the impartiality, the neutrality of that office.
I think it's the Hoffman case that deals with a kind of a subterfuge for a John Doe. That is, they're really using the John Doe to get evidence to build a charge in a different offense. And we said, oh, can't do it there, you know. That's specific. Your definition of abuse is a much more general one than your integrity.
Well, if I may, in using Hoffman, I think there are two things that I got out of Hoffman. First of all, as a general principle, that in these types of proceedings, we have to be very careful. They're secretive. They limit participation. Counsel for witnesses have limited ability to, well, no ability to participate, only to be present. In those situations, as a general matter, the law says you have to take great care to make sure that strict procedures are followed to avoid constitutional violations. So I think Hoffman makes that general statement. Then going more specifically towards abusive prosecutorial tactics. In that case, I believe that the concern was they were using the John Doe proceeding to gather information about someone who was already indicted, and that was considered inappropriate. In this case, Ms. Noble wasn't indicted, but we believe the record at least suggests that she had become the target of that investigation. And even if there's some blurring there, our concern is that these procedures can be used as an investigatory vehicle to actually pursue crimes with the forethought of, pursue prosecutions with the forethought of doing so against witnesses who come to testify. That certainly is the end result here, and we believe the facts suggest that that was what at least the DA and Special Agents Matthews had in mind.
Are you advancing a broader rule, that is, that the act should be void in a criminal case. An act should be void if it is caused by the unauthorized practice of law. That's so inartfully stated. that someone engaging in unauthorized practice of law, that automatically results in voiding or suppressing the...
We're arguing for something more than that, or maybe less than that. We're arguing for a rule that where the unauthorized practice of law or the participation by the unlicensed person in the John Doe hearing has the effect of violating the constitutional rights of the party against whom that evidence is used later, and where there is no other meaningful alternative to suppression, that evidence should be suppressed.
And what's the constitutional right here that's being violated?
There are a few. First of all, in the O'Connor case, and again, recognizing that the court may view Ms. Noble as just a witness or potentially as a target, the O'Connor case says that the secrecy of the John Doe proceeding is a privilege that belongs to the witness. That indicates that the witness does have some rights and some privileges. In this instance, we would suggest that the witness has the constitutional right to give testimony in a proceeding with a neutral magistrate or neutral judicial officer, and in a manner that is fair and unbiased with regard to her interests.
What constitutional right would that be?
The Fourth Amendment would be one part of the Constitution I would cite to.
Which part of the Fourth Amendment?
The unlawful obtaining of evidence.
Where does the Fourth Amendment say that?
Well, I haven't looked at the Fourth Amendment recently, Your Honor. I was going back to my law school days.
Counsel, can I just follow up on that? Because your opposing counsel was asked, well, what if, or she said, if Mr. Matthews had just sat next to the district attorney and had whispered in his ear, she didn't think that would be a violation. You apparently, under the secrecy right, the right of secrecy, would say that nobody should be in that room except A, the district attorney, and B, the judge, and obviously counsel for Ms. Noble. So that would be the same thing. Even if Matthew sat there or... up to the district attorney, Baxter, that still would be a violation, in your opinion.
No, sir.
That wouldn't be.
No, we recognize that in O'Connor, I believe it was O'Connor, that was allowed. The court said under...
What's the secrecy then, because the agent is there?
Well, the court in O'Connor was dealing with this right to secrecy and did indicate that it was the witness's right. In that case, they said, in rare situations where there is a need by the district attorney to have the law enforcement agent there, the judge has the discretion to allow that.
And we don't know here whether, in other words, it's obvious from at least the facts we've looked at here that the judge and or the district attorney who was running the John Doe wanted Mr. Matthews there. You're objecting to Mr. Matthews saying, not being there, but just saying so.
Well, examining the witness.
But the point is, the secrecy, you argued secrecy, it would be the same argument, whether he was there or whether he was asking questions.
Well, and the reason I brought up the secrecy issue in O'Connor was to at least identify some areas of this court's decisions where we believe the witness has a right, and we would contend it's a constitutional right. And I again would focus on the O'Connor case on that, on who that privilege attaches to. Given that the court said that is an instance that should occur only recently or only rarely, that the proceedings should be secret for the benefit and to ensure the rights of the witness, We will allow the judge the discretion to allow a law enforcement agent to be present, but it's a far cry from being present and perhaps whispering a question or two in the ear of the district attorney to then allow the judge to take that discretion and essentially appoint the unlicensed special prosecutor, excuse me, special agent, who coincidentally is also a material prosecution witness, to actually take over the examination, not just suggest questions by whispering into the ear, but actually conduct the examination.
Well, the examination was by both Baxter and Matthews, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. And the reason given for the examination was because Mr. Baxter was not prepared. Again, that, I think, not only constitutes a violation of the witness's rights under O'Connor, but also responds to a question earlier in terms of whether or not this is likely to be repeated in the future. If this is going to be a practice that aids district attorneys who have quite a bit to do and may not have time to get up to speed on a particular issue, then clearly this will be a practice that is repeated in the future.
I still am not tracking on what right of your client is implicated here, constitutional, statutory, or otherwise. At best, I see this as a derivative situation where, as a member of the public, she has a derivative right under the unauthorized practice of law statute to be free from the unauthorized practice of law. But that's the best I can do here is as far as wrapping my mind around what right is implicated here.
And maybe I can try and at least identify some of the things that we've tried to identify in our briefs. In this proceeding, again, focusing in on the unique nature of this proceeding and the rights that would arise, I think, both for the target of the investigation and witnesses, as opposed to what rights someone may have just generally as a member of the general public. O'Connor talked about unique rights that witnesses have, talked about privileges in terms of secrecy, and we believe derivatively talked about privileges against the participation of law enforcement agents as opposed to the district attorney doing the examination. In State versus Doe, taking it a step further and going from the witness to the prospective target of the investigation, in State versus Doe, the court said a person who is the object of an investigation is entitled to substantial rights and due process protections. And we would suggest that one of those due process protections is, again, having the proceedings conducted in an impartial way in which the magistrate or the judge upholds the integrity and the neutrality and the detachment that is discussed at such length in the Ratliff case. And we believe that whether it's a witness or the target of the investigation, when the evidence is gathered in a forum that doesn't have those earmarks of integrity and detachment and neutrality by the judicial officer and as a proceeding itself, that that's a constitutional violation.
Well, I've read the Court of Appeals decision, and the first part of the decision on this issue goes to whether it's a tribunal and whether it's unauthorized practice of law. And they conclude it is unauthorized practice law and that this is a tribunal. And so then they say, okay, what is the remedy? And that's what we're really talking about at the moment, although I recognize there's a difference in position on unauthorized practice of law and on whether this is a tribunal. And then at paragraph 25, the Court of Appeals says that one sanction is suppression. And it clearly recognizes that that's usually constitutional rights, but it can be exceptions to it. And in footnote 8, it gives you some exceptions. And then the court says, and I think that this may be the paragraph, or the sentence, but there are exceptions to this rule, and one exception is where the state abuses John Doe procedure. Here's the kicker sentence. where the state uses a John Doe investigation improperly to gather evidence for use in a pending prosecution, suppression of the witness's testimony and its proof is an appropriate remedy. Isn't that the holding in this? And isn't, and that's what you were saying.
Yes.
Okay, so now we have to say, yeah, the big kick, the kick of word here is improperly. State uses John Doe investigation improperly to gather evidence. Your position is it's improper because it's an unauthorized practice of law.
It's improper because it's an unauthorized practice of law. It's participation by someone other than the DA in gathering that information. It's a violation of the secrecy requirements provided for in the statute and elaborated on by this court in O'Connor, indicating that only in the rarest of circumstances can a law enforcement agent even be present. And I would note in the state's briefs, they talk about that principle, the concern about having law enforcement agents in these grand jury type investigations, and how it's something that's almost unthought of in the federal system. And this court, I think, suggested the same, that it should not be thought of very frequently. Only in those instances where it's absolutely necessary should they even be present. But in this case, this special agent is actually examining the witness.
Counsel,
that's an abuse.
Let me test what's really important to you. Let's say the DA was suspended from the practice of law for failure to comply with CLE requirements. Therefore, was not, during the period of suspension, was not authorized to practice law in the state of Wisconsin. And he did the questioning at the John Doe. Would you be in here asking for the same remedy?
If the judge knew that was a suspended attorney and allowed him to conduct that proceeding, I would. Because I believe that taints whether or not it's a fair, detached, neutral, impartial proceeding.
And if the judge did not know that the DA had been temporarily suspended, let me exaggerate a bit, you wouldn't have a leg to stand on then?
I would have one less leg to stand on.
If the judge mistakenly thought that the law enforcement officer was a new attorney and was not authorized to practice law at all, does that make a difference?
I think it does. I think that's the Ratliff case. In the Ratliff case, the police and the judge and the attorneys, well, the police and the attorneys, excuse me, the police and the judge were trying their best to adhere to the law in terms of recording the information that led to the issuance of the warrant. In the hypothetical you described, the judge is trying to adhere to the law. He's trying to apply it appropriately, and I would assume when he or she finds out that, in fact, the examination was conducted by a non-lawyer, he or she would take steps to rectify it, as the judge in Ratliff did.
I understand, then, that your concern isn't so much with the unauthorized practice of law, but rather the judge's potential for the judge being, as you assert, impartial or unfair. What's driving this?
Our concern is about a proceeding in which the investigator, the prosecutor, and the judge all collaborate to violate the unlawful practice of law statute, the statutes dealing with how John Doe proceedings are to be conducted, and this court's decisions about who can attend, much less participate in those proceedings. So it's not simply that there was an act that is the unauthorized practice of law. If the agent did it, if the agent told the prosecutor and the judge, I'm licensed, why don't you deputize me as an assistant district attorney? That would be a very different case. But in this instance, all three of the parties, all three of the actors who are fundamental to this prosecutorial process were in on the violation of not only the statute prohibiting the unauthorized practice of law, but also the manner in which these proceedings are to be conducted.
Yeah, there was no, do you, I would say, assuming that this was an unwitting violation, this was an unwitting violation. I'm just saying, I don't know whether it was or not. But I noted in the memo that there wasn't your client had an attorney present, and there was no objection. Are you assuming that he thought that Matthews was, you know, practicing attorney?
My understanding from the record is he apparently he did believe that, but my reading of the statute is he has no right to object. The statute's very clear. It says he can be present, but he can't examine, he can't cross-examine, he can't argue.
But he can't object.
Okay. Well, it doesn't provide him with a right to object, only to be present. Your Honors, if I may briefly...
Justice Prosser has... I'm sorry, Justice Babich has a question.
Yes, sir. One question, Counsel. It seems to me that in the lawyer's code of professional responsibility, this kind of conduct would be punishable. Is that not correct?
Well, I would suspect at least there would be an issue in terms of... two things occurred to me. One would be facilitating the unauthorized right. practice of law, and also allowing a material witness to examine another witness in the proceedings. But I would...
Why isn't that a sufficient deterrent?
Well, two reasons, Your Honor. First of all due respect, this court has an obligation and a duty to enforce the legislation passed by the Wisconsin legislature and can't abdicate that to the Lawyers Professional Responsibility Board. And secondly, and I guess related to that, this court and that board have two different purposes and two different focuses in their function. Whether or not the board will pursue this, I don't know. Whether or not the board would give this priority, I don't know. But the court can't simply decide that referring it to the board would be sufficient. Again, whether or not the board would do something about it, I think, is immaterial to whether or not this court has an obligation and a responsibility to take steps. If I could make two brief points before I conclude on the issue. Very brief. On the issue of whether or not this is the unauthorized practice of law, in addition to the fact that this was a judicial tribunal charged with responsibility of adjudicating probable cause, apart from what kind of tribunal it was, this was an individual who was rendering legal services on behalf of the state, and that's an independent basis to determine that there has been a violation of the law. The last point in terms of what the appropriate remedy is, clearly the individuals such as Agent Matthews will never be prosecuted. Not only will the DA and the judge be reticent about pursuing any charges, but as the state has admitted, the Agent Matthews and others who may do this have an ironclad defense based on entrapment, and frankly may even have a defense of absolute immunity based on the doctrine of judicial immunity. So there is no potential prosecution for this violation. We would suggest suppression is the only meaningful alternative.
Thank you, Counsel.
Could I ask
Justice Prosser?
You have 75730 in front of you.
The
unauthorized practice.
Yes, I do.
If you were the prosecutor prosecuting the agent, and you were looking at subsection 2,
mm-hmm.
which words would you be relying on in your complaint?
I would focus on two portions of that section. First of all, appearing and participating as an attorney in a judicial tribunal.
As an attorney?
Appearing. Every person who appears as agent.
As agent, representative, or attorney.
Representative.
And he was acting as the attorney. He was acting as the district attorney in these proceedings. That's our position, is that he stepped into the shoes, to quote the state, at the behest of the state, he stepped into the district attorney's shoes to appear and participate.
There wasn't any there wasn't any representation that he was an attorney, was there?
There was no express representation, but his activities were those of the district attorneys. The statute says only the district attorney may examine. He examined. So whether he called himself an attorney, he played the role of the attorney.
Okay. Well,
the other provision in 2 would be rendering legal services on behalf of any other party. Clearly, he was rendering legal services on behalf of the state.
Right. So that's the last clause.
You have used the term state repeatedly. How confident are you that for or on behalf of any other person, that that word person means state in the statute?
I have not gone to look at the definition for the code to see whether or not that may include. But it was my reading of the statute that they were trying to capture every form of entity, person, firm, partnership, association, corporation. I think the legislature had in mind to try and make this statute as broad as possible. And I think Section 2 illustrates that by talking about three different categories of practicing law, which I think encompasses almost every scenario one could imagine. And I can't believe the legislature intended to provide the state with an exclusion. And in essence say, well, if you're representing the state, you don't have to be licensed. If you're representing the interests of the entire state of Wisconsin, we're not concerned that you be licensed, particularly given the public policy that this statute is intended to protect the general public. I think that requires an interpretation of Section 2 such that those people who purport to represent the state need to be licensed attorneys.
You might look at 990.0126 that defines person to mean body politic. I don't know if that includes the state, but the possibility is also that maybe the person here means the DA. Anyway, it's a lot to think about.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Moeller?
I'd like to spend my last 5 minutes clarifying some of the statements that were made in my opponent's argument. One, there seems to be the belief that John Doe proceedings are necessarily always conducted in secret. That is not the case. The John Doe statute 968.26 specifically states the examination may be adjourned and may be secret. As a practical matter, most John Does are not public hearings, but they can be. So you don't always have a secrecy order. Even if you do have a secrecy order, however, I would take issue with the statement that this somehow confers a constitutional right on a witness in a John Doe. I don't think that a secrecy order gives a witness constitutional rights that he or she otherwise would not have. There are a lot of reasons why the judge might impose secrecy, and one is to protect the reputations of people, either the witnesses or people about whom the testimony is given. Another is simply to have people speak freely without worrying that they're going to have pressures put on them by people who know that they're appearing before the John Doe judge.
Can I just interrupt for a moment? Do you think that a good faith exception can be borrowed from the criminal justice system for suppression here? So regardless of anything else?
Regardless of anything else, if you assume that suppression would otherwise be appropriate, I see no problem with doing that. It would be similar to saying that because a police officer relied on a warrant in making a search, but it turned out the warrant was invalid, there's still a good faith exception. Similarly, you could say it would be somewhat like inevitable discovery, because it didn't make any difference if Ms. Noble was answering questions put to her by Agent Matthews. She would have lied even if the same questions were going to be asked by District Attorney Baxter. So I think you can draw some analogies from Fourth Amendment suppression law. However, the state does not believe that you should even need to get that far in the analysis. The other thing I'd like to clarify are two cases that the Court of Appeals relied on in reaching the conclusion it did, and the cases were also mentioned by the justices in questioning Mr. Boyd. State versus Hoffman, and then this court's later decision in State versus Cummings. In State versus Hoffman, and admittedly this was dictum, but it was still said by the Court of Appeals, that a remedy for abuse of the John Doe process should be suppression. But if you look at the facts in that case, what they were talking about was a very narrow situation where you've already got somebody charged with a crime, and then as further discovery, the prosecutor is using the John Doe to get additional evidence against that particular defendant. And this court in Cummings pretty much cited with approval the language in Hoffman. I think that's a vast difference from what we have here, because even though the court in Hoffman didn't specifically cite a constitutional provision for why it was relying on suppression in that situation, I think there's definitely constitutional due process overtones there, because if a prosecutor were allowed to have all this additional discovery by forcing witnesses to come into a John Doe where there's no rules of evidence apply except for the rules of privilege, the prosecutor would be getting a very unfair advantage over the defendant who's already charged with a crime and would have no similar kind of reciprocal right to discovery. So even though Hoffman doesn't specifically say that this is constitutionally based, I think there are constitutional overtones to the reasoning in that case and to this court's subsequent decision in the Cummings case. Another thing I'd like to point out is under Section 97805, it's true that in enumerating the various duties of a district attorney, the statute makes it sound, by using the word shall, as if district attorneys always have to participate in John Doe proceedings in their counties. That's not true. This court recognized in State versus Washington, 83 Wis Second, it's cited at page 18 of our brief, that although this is the usual scenario, that it's not necessarily the case, that you can have John Doe hearings at which the prosecutor from that county is not involved. One example might be where the complainant in the John Doe is complaining about the prosecutor's misconduct in public office. Certainly there you would not expect the district attorney or his or her assistants to participate. I see that my time has run out, so unless the court has any final questions, the state would simply ask this court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision and to reinstate Ms. Noble's perjury conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, both of you, for the argument in this case. This ends our February sitting and ends our hearing on case number 99-3271 CR. We are adjourned until our March sitting.